correct. And other human beings really don't matter, especially if they're being slaughtered by U.S. weaponry that is so profitable.
And finally, Norman Solomon, the coverage of the anti-war movement, bringing out the voices of those who are opposed to war, looking for a just peace.
Yes, this is part of the mythology of mass media, that we live in this land of the free and home of the brave. And yet, when push comes to shove, we only get from the corporate media glorification or even substantial coverage of anti-war protesters when they're in Moscow. And we should support the anti-war protesters in Moscow. We should also support and publicize and really convey to the American people the messaging of anti-war protesters and a deep reservoir of anti-war belief in this country.
Norman Solomon, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, co-founder of RootsAction.org, author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. The film of that same title, War Made Easy, is produced by the Media Education Foundation. His forthcoming book is titled War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. A belated happy birthday to Tammy Warnoff. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresina, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tamer Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey, Miss.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to the final days of KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2 special programming. You can hear the unique content produced by KBOO creators throughout February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. This Volume 2 special campaign ends on March 25th. Help us reach our goal of $17,000 by donating now. Go to kboo.fm/give or text the word KBOO to 44321. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon legislators move a bill forward to allow Oregonians to pump their own gas. A Manhattan DA is expected to indict former President Trump for hush money payments sometime today. And the Navajo Nation goes to the Supreme Court for treaty rights to the Colorado River. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 21st, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. The Oregon House just approved a bill allowing drivers to pump their own gas. Only two states, Oregon and New Jersey, currently ban self-service gas. Oregon has, in recent years, allowed people to pump their own gas in some rural counties and during heat and COVID-related emergencies, as declared by the governor. House Bill 2426 passed a 47-10 vote and now heads to the Senate. It allows gas stations to designate up to half of their pumps as self-service. In 16 of Oregon's more heavily populated counties, at least one attendant still would need to be present to pump gas for customers who don't want the self-service option. Gas stations would have to charge the same amount for self-service and full-service gas. The Oregon law dates back to 1951. It was rooted in concerns about fire safety and job creation. It actually states those pumping their own gas are potentially subjected to dangers, including fumes, slick surfaces, and leaving children unattended. Pumping your own gas can result in a $500 fine. Changes have been proposed and made over the years. Motorcyclists are currently allowed to pump their own gas. Last year, a proposal quite similar to HB 2426 got stuck in the state's budget writing committee. The Office of the State Fire Marshal said self-service fueling requires more than $1 million for additional staff. 2426 would not require the Fire Marshal's office to enforce the new regulations until March of 2024, which should reduce the impact on the agency. A 2021 survey found that almost two-thirds of Oregonians supported changing the law to allow pumping their own gas. Some opposed the change, believing it would make things difficult for those with disabilities. Others may feel unsafe exiting their vehicles after dark. HB 2426 is supported by the Oregon Fuels Association, which represents locally owned fuel stations, fuel distributors, and heating oil providers. Republicans respond to former President Trump's potential indictment from a Manhattan district attorney. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis broke his silence on the possible indictment facing former President Donald Trump over payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels in 2016 to stay quiet about an alleged affair with Trump. DeSantis also took the chance to jab Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, saying he's pursuing his own political agenda after receiving campaign donations in 2021 from liberal philanthropist George Soros. On Monday, President Joe Biden vetoed a Republican-backed measure that would ban the government from considering environmental impacts or possible lawsuits when considering people's retirement plans.
I just signed this veto because the legislation passed by the Congress would put at risk the retirement savings of individuals across the country.
Biden said he vetoed the bill because it risked the retirement savings of individuals across the country. During the House Republicans' annual retreat in Florida, House Budget Committee Chairman Jody Arrington said he's worried about the country's future because of President Joe Biden's proposed budget plan, which he says doubles down on the out-of-control spending.
The outlook is bleak, but it's not hopeless. We just have to intervene in a responsible way, and we have to turn what is the Titanic, really, because we didn't get here overnight. We won't get out of it overnight.
Arrington said GOP lawmakers remain committed to cut spending. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Arizona v. Navajo Nation, a case that looks at whether the United States government is obligated to fulfill Native American reservations' water needs. The Navajo Nation argues it was promised sufficient water when the government entered into a treaty with them in 1868. While some justices seemed uncertain whether taking more water from the shrinking Colorado River was the right move, Justice Elena Kagan agrees that promises made to the Navajo Nation had been broken.
It's a contract that promises something. You're saying those rights are unenforceable. And I guess I don't understand, if the treaty promises water, where you get the idea that that is unenforceable.
Finally, actor Jason Sudeikis and the cast of Ted Lasso were at the White House to shed light on the importance of mental health. Sudeikis said President Biden and his team were working to make sure Americans knew about options available to help with mental health.
No matter who you are, no matter where you live, no matter who you voted for, we all know someone who has, or have been that someone ourselves, actually, that's struggled, that's felt isolated.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our ATRUST indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Navajo Nation is in front of the Supreme Court this week regarding the treaty rights it has to the Colorado River, which they call broken promises. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. On Monday, the Navajo Nation went before the United States Supreme Court to argue it has a right to Colorado River water, dating back to an 1868 treaty. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
There's no running water on more than 30% of the Navajo Nation, and households on the reservation that do have running water only have access to about one-tenth of the water average U.S. households use. Why? Broken promises, reads the tribe's brief before the Supreme Court. After more than two decades of a drought in the Southwest, tribes have been demanding a seat at the table.
More tribes are actively pursuing their water rights. It's a deal. It's very daunting.
That's Mark Macaro, tribal chair of the Pechanga Band of Indians in Southern California and first vice president of the National Congress of American Indians.
Tribes have a right to water, right?
Yeah.
That's the whole premise of federal Indian water law.
Yeah.
When their homeland was created, there's an implied right to water that goes with it. Beyond that, how much? How much water,
exactly.
Right? So that's the rub.
The case could have far-reaching impacts for tribes across the West because two decades of drought have had lasting impacts, including on bringing reservoirs like Lake Powell to historic lows. Christina Aspas is Navajo from New Mexico.
Look at Lake Powell now.
Yeah.
that is so down.
Yeah.
And a lot of that water also ran down the little Colorado River, and that was also to a hydro plant.
Yeah.
And nobody talks to us. You know, they make these plans up here with these industries, but nobody came to us to ask.
The Biden White House is aligned with Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, and some California water districts in opposing the Navajo Nation's water claims. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
An indigenous professor is conducting a survey to learn more about the millions of American Indian and Alaska Native people living in urban areas. Emma Vandernindy of the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
The nationally reaching survey asks questions like if they live in an apartment or a house. It also asks about the conditions of their housing and their experience finding it. Sophia Locklear is a professor at Western University in Canada, and she's from the Lumbee tribe in North Carolina. She launched the survey 2 months ago, hoping to get 50 responses. Since then, she's received nearly 800.
That signals that, like, people want to talk about this. You know, I'm getting emails, people saying, I really want to tell you my story about trying to find housing.
There are no concrete results yet, but Locklear says responses reflect the country's colonialism and racism towards Indigenous people.
So everybody I've talked to, sure, has so far had some hard things happen in their experiences of finding housing, but they also are really brilliant at navigating that.
Her goal is to use this data to inform policy and allocate funds to American Indian and Alaska Native people. For National Native News, I'm Emma Vandenide.
And some exciting news. Congratulations to our sister program, Native America Calling, which is owned by our Alaska-based company, Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. The one-hour live call-in talk show, which connects listeners from across the country to Indigenous issues, has been awarded a National Humanities Medal. President Joe Biden will present our president and CEO, Jacqueline Salee, with a medal during a White House ceremony on Tuesday. I'm Jill Freitas.
Two American banks collapsed last week, prompting financial uncertainty. As Eric Tegedoff reports, some are looking at the alternative structure of credit unions as a better option.
The collapse of two banks has put the U.S. financial sector into focus this week. Some are considering the alternative structures of institutions like credit unions. Troy Stang is head of the Go West Credit Union Association, which represents more than 300 credit unions in Oregon and five other states. He says tumult in the financial market historically generates interest in the local structure of credit unions.
Whether it was with the dot-com bust, whether it was with the activities that led up to the Great Recession, consumers at their kitchen tables started having these conversations more intentionally about who is it that we do our financial services with.
Silicon Valley Bank's collapse is the second largest bank collapse in U.S. history. To get depositors their money, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has stepped in. Stang notes that National Share Insurance Fund, administered by the National Credit Union Administration, is the equivalent regulator for his institutions and is paid for by the credit union system. Stang says credit unions are not-for-profit and member-owned.
We're not accountable to Wall Street investors. We're not accountable to other forces outside of our membership. And so it's a much different model.
Stang says many of the credit unions in his association have spent the last week reassuring customers and noting differences in their institution structure from others. He adds a strong financial system is important for consumers, regardless of which institution they bank with. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
At a UCLA conference on threats to democracy, election officials called for more funding and measures to build trust in elections in order to combat disinformation. Suzanne Potter has more on the conference.
American democracy is in mortal danger as the 2024 election approaches, according to experts at a conference held at UCLA on Friday. Millions of Americans still believe the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen, and the insurrection that took place on January 6, 2021 proves that some are willing to resort to violence. UCLA law professor Rick Hassan says some groups are actively working against the will of the voters.
Election deniers won office in non-swing states, and many are in Congress. Local election officials have shared voting machine code with conspiracy theorists, and some local election boards have tried to require the hand count of ballots or refuse to certify election results.
In December, Congress passed reforms to the Electoral Count Act of 1887, a rare bipartisan move to make it harder to attempt to overturn the results of a presidential election, as former President Trump did in 2020. Republicans have defeated Democratic proposals to reduce the influence of money in politics and expand access to voting. Neil Kelly, who retired after serving as Registrar of Voters in Orange County for 20 years, says citizens must combat efforts to undermine trust in the election system.
We should continue to expand audits, partner with prosecutors on any violations of election law, improve the voter experience, and use election materials to communicate facts about misinformation directly with voters.
Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson said election denier groups are trying to infiltrate local elections offices.
I have found the effort to replace people of integrity in every potential position in democracy, from poll workers to secretaries of state, with people who are not beholden to the law and the principles of democracy and are willing to skirt the law to advance political goals.
Michigan Democrats are pursuing bills to increase the penalty for harassing election workers and to ban deceptive practices in elections, such as lying to voters when seeking petition signatures and knowingly share false information about elections and the ability to vote. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler says that the homeless encampment sweeps he ordered last year have contributed to a decrease in the number of unhoused Portlanders struck by cars. However, a safety manager from the Portland Bureau of Transportation, also known as PBOT, told the Portland Mercury that the mayor's conclusion is based on limited data, and the decrease could just be within the standard range of variation year to year. PBOT went on to say that other factors could have been at play, but because they have only been collecting that data for 2 years, there's not enough history to identify a pattern. 63 Portlanders were killed in traffic crashes in 2022, and in 2021, 70% of those victims were unhoused at the time. The mayor has said that those statistics are a major factor in his decision to remove tents and other temporary dwellings from areas near major roadways last year. PBOT spokesperson Dylan Rivera also told the Mercury that the agency would not be using the decrease in unhoused pedestrian deaths to create any policy recommendations. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on surveillance, privacy, and technology. At 6, it's Trans Positive. At 7 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will have scattered thunderstorms and a daytime high of 63. Today in history, in 1990, Namibia gains its independence from South Africa. The quote of the day is from poet Anne Bradstreet, who wrote, quote, "If we had no winter, the spring would not be so pleasant. If we did not sometimes taste adversity, spring would not be so welcome." Armadillos are moving north in the U.S. as a result of changing temperatures and climate change. The armored animals have been found in climates that were once thought to be too cold for them. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When homeowners in Illinois see a freshly dug hole in their lawn, few suspect it's an armadillo. But in recent decades, these small armored animals have established populations as far north as southern Illinois and Indiana. These areas were once thought to be too chilly. Armadillos are hairless, so they're vulnerable to low temperatures. When it's cold, they also struggle to find food, because the worms and bugs they eat burrow deep underground. But Augustine Jimenez of Southern Illinois University says armadillos have proven that they can survive some frigid days.
They can actually go and form a den. In that area, they could be isolated from the fluctuations that occur in the exterior.
Researchers now believe that armadillos can thrive as long as average minimum temperatures stay above about 17 degrees Fahrenheit. And as the climate warms, those conditions and ample food are increasingly found farther north. Jimenez says that when winters are warmer, worms and grubs stay closer to the surface of the ground, where it's easier for armadillos to find them.
The warmer the weather, the more food there will be for them.
So gardeners, beware. These voracious diggers could be headed your way. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A Kentucky bill that would nullify federal gun laws is headed to Governor Andy Beshear's desk. It would make it illegal for state and local law enforcement officers to assist with the enforcement of federal gun laws. As Nadia Romligan reports, some residents are concerned that the law could hamper efforts to protect communities from rising levels of gun violence.
A bill that would make it more difficult for local police to enforce federal gun laws and, in some cases, criminally penalize them now heads to Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear's desk. Kentucky lawmakers have secured enough votes to override a veto. House Bill 153 bans state and local law enforcement and other public officials from enforcing federal firearms regulations enacted after January 1, 2021. Some residents, including Kentucky Moms Demand Action volunteer Kathy Hobart, say they're concerned House Bill 153 could hamper efforts to protect communities from rising levels of gun violence.
What we know is that the more guns that are in circulation, the more likely they are to be stolen, the more likely they are to get into the hands of people that have no business having those guns, like children and criminals.
According to Mental Health America, 85% of suicide attempts with a firearm result in death. More than 800 Kentuckians died by suicide in 2020, and 65% involved a firearm. Kentuckians in crisis can call 988 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to speak with suicide prevention and mental health counselors. Hobart adds that it's not up to states to decide which federal laws they're going to enforce. She also points out the legislation's vague wording could create confusion among police officers.
It makes it difficult for law enforcement to know which laws to enforce, and that will lead to confusion. We think it will lead to more gun crime in the long run.
Supporters of the bill argue the federal government, not the state of Kentucky, is responsible for enforcing its own gun laws. Last week, President Biden signed an executive order strengthening background check requirements for firearm dealers. This is Nadia Romligan for Kentucky News Connection.
States in the U.S. that outlaw abortion may run afoul of the United Nations Charter and other documents on human rights. Amnesty International has plans to take the U.S. to court over the matter. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Abortion is illegal in 13 U.S. states and in several others is severely restricted. Does that make the U.S. an international outlaw? A number of human rights groups, such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, and some legal experts think so, and they have petitioned the United Nations to persuade it to pursue a case against the U.S. for violating various U.N. conventions. As the legal director of the Global Justice Center, one of the petitioners, put it, the U.S. must be castigated on the world stage for its treatment of women, girls, and others who can become pregnant. The scale and intensity of human rights violations that the U.S. is inflicting on its population are near unfathomable at this point. The U.S. government, as a U.N. member, is obliged to follow the principle of equal rights of men and women that is in the U.N. Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That declaration also includes an equal protection article that bars discrimination by law on the basis of sex. Two other basic U.N. documents that underscore male-female equality also have been signed and ratified by the U.S. government: the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The human rights groups that are petitioning here also cite the UN's Convention on Torture. But the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, C-E-D-A-W, is a prominent exception. The convention came into force in 1981. President Jimmy Carter signed it. He and President Bill Clinton submitted it to the U.S. Senate for ratification, but it has failed each time to win approval. This CEDAW convention stipulates everything progressives and liberals would want to see in the U.S. Constitution, an equal rights amendment, in short. For example, Article 12 states that parties shall take all appropriate measures to eliminate discrimination against women in the field of health care and access to health care services, including family planning. And that party shall ensure to women appropriate services in connection with pregnancy, confinement, and the postnatal period, granting free services where necessary, as well as adequate nutrition during pregnancy and lactation. But for over 40 years, the Women's Rights Convention has always faced the same objections, that the UN has no right to legislate and cannot supersede federal or state laws, that women cannot be guaranteed equal pay for equal work, that women cannot be made to serve in the armed forces in the same way as at the same level as men, that paid maternity leave cannot be guaranteed, and, most pertinent to the abortion issue, that family planning and health care requirements under the convention do not create a right to an abortion. Since the U.S. has never ratified the CEDAW, it is not bound by its provisions. For the same reason, actions cannot be brought against the U.S. in the committee that monitors compliance with the convention. That circumstance, along with the traditional U.S. rejection of an international body's right to overrule U.S. domestic law, will make it very difficult to bring U.S. anti-abortion cases to courts outside the U.S. Even the Biden administration's strong support of Roe v. Wade may not, for political reasons, go to the point of supporting those human rights groups that want the UN to act. Nevertheless, the abortion case shows that the U.S. is defying international law despite forever preaching about the rule of law. The historical record is clear. The U.S. has often acted contrary to international law when it suits its interests, just like most other countries, and human rights in particular have been the most frequently violated norm, such as racial injustice, bombing of military targets that caused civilian deaths, provision of arms used by authoritarian governments to repress civil liberties, sanctions that mainly harm the innocent, separation of immigrant families at the border, and so on. Moreover, enforcement of U.S. human rights violations in an international court is equally problematic. Even when international courts or other bodies do rule against the U.S., the rulings are often not obeyed, on the grounds that U.S. domestic law is not subject to non-U.S. courts or involves national security, or, worse still, should not even be informed by legal theory or practice in foreign countries. We see this example of American exceptionalism behind the U.S. refusal to join the International Criminal Court, which would expose the U.S. to violations of humanitarian law and the conduct of military and intelligence operations. Yet the U.S. will trumpet the conviction of Vladimir Putin by that same court for war crimes. As with the refusal to ratify the CEDAW, not joining the International Criminal Court on the grounds that an international body must not impose its law on Americans is a cop-out, an attempt to escape responsibility for human rights violations. That's not a legacy worthy of a democracy that trumpets the rule of law. We might therefore want to speak not about the outlawing of abortion in the U.S., but about this country's outlaws on abortion. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 21st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Dave Rosenberg, Michelle Coppola, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Nadia Ramlagan, Jill Freitas, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
I love you, KBOO.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, March 25th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. for our 2023 Bluegrass Marathon. live at Multnomah Green 71. Uncle Chippy and Josh will kick off the marathon at 9 with a journey back to 1971, along with live recordings from local and regional acts. At noon, we'll head down to the Grange for live performances from several of Portland's finest bluegrass bands. Performers include Josh Cole Band, Sawtooth, Sunny South, and more. The event is also open to the public, so bluegrass fans are invited to join us down at the Grange. More information can be found at kboo.fm/bluegrass23.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It seems so easy these days for large institutions, as well as hackers, to access your personal information, a point that was brought home even more strongly by the revelations of the National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden back in 2013. So how does one escape from the dangers of potential digital intrusions, privacy violations, malware attacks, and identity theft, to name just a few of the problems we face today because of the nature of our so-called advanced technology? William Blunden is a security analyst and a professor at San Francisco State University. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
Since the, during the time of the Edward Snowden revelations, there seemed to be a lot of concern about people spying or the NSA spying on Americans. And every once in a while, we hear about some corporation who might have too much of our information. And then, of course, there's breaches in their systems that allow even more people to have access to our information. And meanwhile, we're being encouraged to go online to do so much of our business. Where do you see all this going? Is this just going to continue as it has been, where more and more of our information is